As I walked around part of the room, I found a number of Kansans. I can understand why our population hasn't kept pace, because there are a number of people leaving Kansas. Many have left since I've been their senator. I don't know if there's any connection, but I went back and I met a friend of mine. I said to Tom Lillard, I remember I first drove into Salina, Kansas. I didn't know many people in Salina, Kansas. That was a big city, 40,000 people, and I came from a city of six. And I walked into Tom Lillard's office and told him I was running for Congress, and he said, I'm glad to hear it. And that was about the end of the conversation. But later on, he agreed to help me in Saline County, Kansas, and because of his efforts, we did quite well there. Then I found two other ladies who've helped in my campaigns in Kansas, Mrs. Alden and Mrs. Sims, both in the Hutchinson County area. Then I've also found a relative here. I want to get all these acknowledgments made in case I lose and run for Congress in the 10th District sometime. So I don't know who was in the middle of the room or on the right-hand side, but I was doing pretty well over there on the left-hand side. I think it was about 3 weeks ago that Elizabeth and I were in Carbondale with Senator and Mrs. Percy. We had a great time that evening. We had a very, very much of a fun evening that night. We had a great crowd. In fact, as I told Senator Percy, I couldn't see the end of the crowd. It was such a great crowd in a long, long dining hall that I assumed they were all in our meeting, but I couldn't tell. And Sam, you have about the same size crowd, and I'm very pleased to be here. I like to go to nonpartisan meetings like this. And I'm not going to make a partisan speech. I'm going to tell you the truth about Governor Carter. And I think it's about time somebody told the American people the truth about Governor Carter. Now, first, I want you know the big news now is that someone has leaked something from an excerpt that hasn't been published in a book that hasn't been published about former President Nixon. I think I had four interviews upstairs a while ago, and I had four different questions on whether or not former President Nixon is innocent. I said I had reservations. I said a number of other things, but I think it indicates everybody in the country is now going to ask, is he innocent or guilty? Well, I don't know. I have my own thoughts on the matter, but it seems to me that to start commenting on something that hasn't even been released in a book that hasn't even been written, I think the author is trying to promote that book, and I guess if everybody in the country comments on whether or not this happened or that happened, it might improve the sales. But I only mention that because a couple of the networks didn't have a chance to get up there, and I wanted to comment so they'd have it for whatever purpose they might want it for. So Bob, I've taken care of that. So... now we get into the serious business. I hope you watch the first debate. How many here watched the first debate? Good. Well, there'll be another debate. And then there's going to be a third debate with Senator Dole and Senator Mondale. And if you don't have time to watch it, I'll send you a transcript after the election. It's going to be on a Friday night, which is a great night for American high school football. And I imagine many of you will have to make a difficult choice and will then decide to go to the football game. But I'll understand, and Senator Mondale will understand, because we recognize that even though we try harder, we're still number two. So, and I think... we don't know what we're going to talk about. We've been debating for years in the Congress. When he votes yes, I vote no. When he votes no, I vote yes. And if they had to pick two senators who could leave the Senate for a month or 5 weeks, as we've done, and never change a vote in the Congress, they couldn't have found two better senators. I like Senator Mondale. I think he does a great job in the Senate. I think you'll do a great job there next year. I like Governor Carter, what little I know about him. It's hard to find out much. They did finally agree on three debates so he could state all of his positions on the issues on three separate nights. So if you've only listened to the first debate, you've still got two positions to go. But we've been trying to figure out Governor Carter. He has been talking more lately. A number of interviews are floating around. Some are stuck in between pictures, and I would guess that... And I want to point that out so you don't spend all the time on the pictures. You ought to read the interviews. They say a picture is worth, 10,000 words? But I think in this case... Well, I can't say because I haven't seen the pictures. But I'm glad he is starting to open up a little. He has many opportunities for interviews, and recently he's been upset with the press. And I can understand that. Now and then I make little comments off the top of my head that upset some of the press. But we get along fairly well. I haven't had any closed meetings, off-the-record sessions with the press that traveled me and complained to them about the bad treatment I've had. But apparently Governor Carter did that last week. I think it indicates that Governor Carter has some problems. I think it indicates he has a problem in Illinois. I think you would share that view. He's going to lose the state of Illinois. President Ford's going to carry the state of Illinois. When we came in tonight, we expected to have a torchlight parade, but apparently the mayor didn't get the word that I was here. And we've had a number of indications that Daley is going to support Carter. And you know, he can't win them all, so he can have Daley, and we'll take the people of Illinois, and we'll win on November 2nd with the people of Illinois. And the mayor's also said, in fact, he's told his fellow Democrats, that together they could climb to higher platitudes. And if you're looking for higher platitudes, you've got the right man in Governor Carter. He'll take you higher and higher and higher. In fact, he said that he likes to shade his positions a little bit, sort of tailor his policies to the audience. And if he walked in here, I assume he'd give his moderate to conservative speech. I've often wondered what would happen if he went to the wrong meeting. But I think perhaps as we look around and talk about time for change, the Democrat candidate keeps saying it's time for change. But first, I think the American people want to see some evidence that he's a leader. When we try to learn what changes he means to bring, we find he offers no change at all, but rather return to the past of big spending and bigger government. And I think the Americans understand that distinction, and there is a very clear distinction between being led forward and dragged backward. And every time Mr. Carter opens his mouth, he makes this distinction more clear. And as his campaign grinds to a halt, I think that's probably a fair assumption. Right now, he's down in Plains, Georgia. And Plains has been developing a lot lately, and there's a lot of interest in Plains, Georgia. I think he's thinking about settling there permanently after November 2nd. But as his campaign comes to this halt, Governor Carter is becoming increasingly desperate in his attacks on the president. And Mr. Carter now says that foreign policy under President Ford has not met the moral standards of Roosevelt, Truman, Kennedy, and Johnson policies. Well, I think Mr. Carter would do well to limit his discussions of morality to magazine interviews and not try to inject them into the area of foreign policy, where he has no experience, no expertise, and apparently no historical perspective. So it's not clear. It's really not clear what Mr. Carter finds moral in the foreign policies of previous Democrat administrations. All I remember is that between Truman and Kennedy, we had President Eisenhower, who, faced with international provocation again and again, proved that wars are not inevitable, and that strong leadership and excellent statecraft can prevent war. So he stopped the war begun under Harry Truman and refused to commit troops to a new war in Asia. I'd call that morality in foreign policy under Dwight David Eisenhower. And like President Eisenhower, President Ford has faced provocation on the international scene. And instead of allowing us to be drawn into war, he has acted to preserve peace. And if there is morality in foreign policy, it seems to me that some major part of it involves preserving peace without sacrificing liberty. Now, if Mr. Carter differs with that conclusion, he ought to be more precise in spelling out the differences. But we should no more expect precision in an explanation of his views on foreign policy than we can expect candor in his discussion on domestic affairs. You know what's happened. He's been running against our nation's capital for months. He won a number of primaries. He lost 6 out of the last 8. But he was nominated. He is the candidate in that great Democratic Party. He condemns Washington. He condemns all its ways. He attacks a massive bureaucracy created by his own party and promised that he would reorganize the government. And when he's been pushed and he's been pushed, he's been asked and asked and asked, how are you going to do this, Governor Carter? Well, he said he hasn't had time to formulate a plan. And this is a man who's been running for president for more than 2 years. And now he tells us he doesn't have time to figure out how he would fulfill one of his principal campaign promises. But if you're fascinated by what he doesn't say, you'll be absolutely amazed by what he does say. And let me tell you just a little about that. He's promised big government spending programs in excess of $100 billion. But he has refused to say how he's going to pay for those. And that's not unusual in liberal circles. You just talk about the programs, talk about all the good you're going to do for the American people, and then saddle them with some enormous debt and raise their taxes and cause a raise in inflation and go merrily on your way. He's also said, you know, in addition to the one interview that we've alluded to, he had an interview about tax reform with the Associated Press. I didn't have the interview. President Ford didn't have the interview. We didn't seek out an interview on tax reform. Maybe he didn't either, but he had the interview. And he's promised to increase taxes on all families with above the median income. I'm talking about families above the median income. Not individuals, but families. Working wife, working husband, children, whatever. The one thing he forgot to check is what was the median income for an American family. It's not $50,000. It's not $30,000. It's $14,000. And I would guess a great many Americans were somewhat surprised. I know one who was, Senator Mondale. He rushed up to Lewistown, Maine the next day and said, well, Governor Carter meant $50,000. And I was accused of distorting what he said. I didn't distort anything. I just read what he said. So when that blew up in his face, he said, well, he wouldn't increase taxes for that group after all. He said he would only increase the taxes on the rich. Well, I don't know who the rich are, but it's rather a glittering generality. No matter how much you tax them, you can't increase revenues very much. And of course, I'm always reminded that Mr. Carter talks a great deal about taxes. He mentioned taxes in the debate. He likes to use those buzzwords, the rich. He calls President Ford insensitive. He called President Johnson, former President Johnson, in effect a liar and a cheat, as he did former President Nixon. Then he rushed to the phone and called Lady Bird and apologized that he didn't really mean it. Well, I wonder about a man's judgment. I wonder about a man's judgment. I wonder about the man himself who can walk into this room and criticize everyone here and then stand up and say, trust me. Trust me. I always thought trust was something that had to be earned. You don't earn trust by condemning everyone in sight and coming up with some instant apology. I think you ought to read some of the buzzwords in his speeches. He stands before an audience and he says he will represent the working men and women, the average American, the middle-income Americans, the low-income Americans. But he doesn't tell them that the Congress has been controlled by Democrats for the last 22 years straight. He doesn't tell those people making below the poverty income that he believes in the investment tax credit. So do I. I think it stimulates the economy. It stimulates business. But he believes in that. That's not a loophole. He talks about loopholes. Loopholes here, loopholes there. All designed for the rich. Well, I noticed in 1975 his tax liability was $68,000. But he reduced it by $41,000 by using the tax credit. The net result, he paid 12.8%. of his income for taxes. I doubt that many in this room did that well. So he can stand before the average American. This is the same man who said in New York that our national tax system is a disgrace. He didn't say again that the Democrats have controlled the Congress 40 out of 44 years. A week later, where was he? He was in New York. He met with some small businessmen in Club 21. The host of that luncheon was Henry Ford, one of those small businessmen that Governor Carter talks about. And he said, don't worry about taxes. Don't worry about taxes. I won't do anything for a year. Well, he's not going to do anything for several years. He's not even going to be there. He attacks the president because we have no energy policy. And conveniently fails to point out that the president submitted a sweeping proposal for a national energy policy to the Congress in January of this year. And the Congress has not bothered to act at all. And he talks, as I said, about loopholes, about the tax system being a national disgrace. He lays that disgrace at the doors of the White House. He either doesn't know or he refuses to tell the people that tax reform and taxes generally are initiated in the Congress, in the House of Representatives, not the President. So I think I'm getting up to the point where I want to say a minute or two. We're going to win the election on November 2nd. We're going to win the election. Now, the best thing that could happen to President Ford, I figured out if he makes it, I'm going to make it, so I'll just talk about him. I'm just the bonus you get. I think I've told this group, somebody asked me how I got into politics, and just very quickly, I went to a fundraiser one night when I was first in Congress, and they were really trying to raise money, and I got there. The advance ticket sale had reached 10. And no one knew me, and no one cared, no one bought any tickets. And so they rushed me out to the radio station trying to figure out some way to drum up some support. So they asked me all these questions, and I responded. They put me in the car, and they took me back to town. And on the way back, we turned on the car radio, and the announcer was saying that I was born in Kansas, reared in Kansas, went to school in Kansas, that I was a pre-medical student prior to World War II, that I suffered a serious head injury, and then went into politics. So I don't know how Sam Young got into politics, but I know I got into politics. I guess with his hearing impediment, somebody said, well, you run. He didn't hear him. The next thing, he was running for Congress. You're going to have to borrow Chuck Percy's hearing aid. I think you're better off if you don't hear a lot of this. At the left ear. He hadn't heard a word all evening. I wondered why he wanted his left ear up to me. Well, we'll bring a translator next time and you'll... I was just going to say we needed him in Congress, but if you hadn't heard any other thing, you won't hear this. You can't blame him for what happened. He didn't even hear it. Well, I couldn't take the oath that raise your right hand. I've never taken the oath. I've been in Congress all these years. So I'm not responsible for anything that happened. I've never really been a member of Congress. We get a lot of Bob Hope stuff, and then we dress it up a little and use it. But it's a... See, now we're... The reason I'm stalling here, Lyle, I got up to this point, then I discovered I brought the 4-H speech for the rest, for the balance, and that's... So... I was just ready to make the big pitch, and I lost my place, but that... It is Young, Young's the name? Yeah, Sam Young, right, wow, we got... We're very, very close, you know. We've known each other for years. It's a name I can spell anyway, and I'm... And some people say, how did you get on the ticket? And more people are asking that every day. Believe me, how do you get on the ticket? And I won't bore you, but it all happened on the 19th of August, and they were down to four running, and... At least they were speculating there were going to be four, and we heard it on the news, and the first name mentioned was Mrs. Armstrong, and you had to be back in Kansas City by noon so you could go out with the president. He could lead you out and say, this is it. We learned she was in Scotland. No way she could get back, so we took her name off the list. The next name was Bill Ruckelshaus, an outstanding Republican in Indiana, but he was up in Tacoma, Washington. And that's a long way from Kansas City. Besides, his name's too long for a button. So we took him off the list. And that left Senator Baker and Senator Dole. And I said to my wife, Elizabeth, if they don't go in alphabetical order, I think we've got a chance. And so about that time, the press started gathering in the hall. They're always gathering somewhere, but this time they were gathering in the hall. And I was... Our suite was, our little room, very small, about the size of this podium. We only been there a week, but we were right next to the suite of Governor Conley. He's from Texas, you know. And so I told Elizabeth, because all these press were gathering in the hall, I said, just go to the door and put your ear down there and see what they're saying. Now, that's legal in Kansas City if you listen from the inside out, so there's no problem with that. So she heard my name mentioned. She heard the name Dole. We didn't know whether somebody wanted relief or whether they were drinking pineapple juice. But in any event, I shaved and got ready, and we just sort of stayed in the room just in case the phone would ring. And it did ring, but because we were so near Governor Conley's suite that I accepted before I identified myself, thinking the president might have gotten the wrong numbers. And that's how it happened. And that's how it happened. So. I want to say very seriously that Sam Young's loss in 74 was not just a loss to this district. And not just a loss to the Republican Party, it was a loss to the country. And we need Sam Young back in the Congress, and I say that very seriously. Now, I can't stand here with a straight face and say we're going to control the Congress, but I can stand here with a straight face in all honesty and say we're going to make gains in the Congress, and Sam Young's going to be one of the gains we make in the Congress. I think we've had enough of that Harry Hopkins philosophy of tax and tax and spend and elect. And I think they're tired, the American people are tired, and you're tired in this district of candidates who have never learned that the shortest way to the people's confidence is a straight line, and that's what you have with Sam Young. And let me conclude by this. I just want to close on a note about Carter. Not the Carter you mentioned, John, from Ohio. Governor Carter professes sympathy for those who cannot afford to buy homes. And he says he would eliminate tax exemptions for home mortgages. When that became a political liability for him, he said he would not eliminate the exemption. Now, which statement does he stand by? He says he supports unionization of farm workers in California, but he won't let union organizers on his property in Georgia. As I said, he smears President Johnson, then he calls his widow and says, "I'm sorry." Now, what the people of this nation need to know is how in God's name we're supposed to know the difference between what Mr. Carter says and what Mr. Carter means. He's had the tirade against the press because he says they're not fair. They give all the soft questions to Mr. Ford. Well, I can tell you that I get my fair share of hard ones, so we can sort of divide those up. But I think time is running out on Mr. Carter, and the tide of public opinion is running against him. And I just want to say that being president is a very awesome responsibility. And as I watch debates, and I'll admit my bias, and I was prepared to think that Ford won, and I was all set, and then the debate started, and I watched very carefully, and I concluded, as nearly every poll has shown in America, that Governor Ford not only won, he won very easily over Governor Carter because he knew the facts, he knew the programs, and he projected that image of confidence and competence and leadership. And that's what it's all about. That's what it's all about. Oh. I guess I just made Ford the governor. Well, let's put him back in a White House. But I've known President Ford for 16 years. Sam Young knows President Ford. Many people in this audience know President Ford very well. And he's the same honest, decent, candid, open American today as he was when he went into that White House in those tragic days in August of 1974. And we are at peace in the world. And the economy is recovering. And we have restored dignity and decency to the White House. President Ford has led the way, and I just ask this group, oh yes, we want to be elected, not just because of what might do for Jerry Ford or Bob Dole or Sam Young or whoever may be running, not just because we're Republicans and you're Republicans or Democrats or independents leaning our way, but I firmly believe it's in the national interest. I believe we need President Ford's leadership, and I say to those who are looking, you wouldn't buy a used peanut or a used anything else. When you have something done in your home or anywhere else, you look for someone with experience. And I just say very earnestly, President Ford has that experience. He has it in foreign policy. He has it in domestic policies. You know where he stands. And let's stand up for President Ford on November 2nd. Thank you very much.
This to you, and as a Republican, you know we're well.
Thank you very much, Mayor. What is it? Oh, thanks very much. I want to cover the mayor's face, sir.
Senator, you going to carry
Pennsylvania? Oh, yeah, we're going to carry Pennsylvania. I understand it's almost a dead heat right now, and we really believe that there's a lot of movement in the campaign, as I've said, and it's moving in our direction. We've had very enthusiastic crowds wherever we've gone. We just believe people wouldn't turn out unless they had some reason to, and we conclude that they want President Ford elected. Well, I think President Ford has done that for the most part with his openness and his candor, and just seems to me that there's going to be a hangover for some time. There's always been a certain amount of distrust of anyone in public office, but I think the climate's much better. It's up to us to be open and candid and respond, and that we've tried to do.
Senator, dinner, Jimmy Carter was here September 20th. He said you were the party of the special interest. How do you respond to that?
Well, we think we're special, but we don't think we're the party of the special interest. We believe we represent all Americans. I don't know whether George Meany represents a special interest or not, but he certainly has control of that party. And that candidate, he went up and had lunch right after his coronation with Henry Ford, one of those small businessmen he talks about. Is that a special interest? It just seems to me that... That's an easy charge to make. We believe we represent the views of most Americans, the majority of the American people. Okay. Thank you. They're all going to get wet.
What effect do you think it will have on carrying Pennsylvania and the rest of the nation?
I don't really think it'll have any, but I assume that President Ford... President Ford's already responded to the golf game, as far as I know. There are some other matters that haven't been responded to, but I think it'll come.
Thank you. Thank you.
Narrowing the gap as the campaign progresses, and if so, why?
I think there is a lot of movement. I don't have any recent surveys. I think in Pennsylvania it's almost a dead heat. That's the most recent polling information. I think a great deal of the movement because of people perceive President Ford as a man of competence, and he can project that leadership. He has experience. I think on the other hand, they're curious about Carter. There's doubt about Carter because of some of his judgments recently. But it really seems to me that it's going to be a tough election. On November 2nd.
You were in Chicago yesterday or last night, and the United Press quoted you as saying that Carter's taking one position here and another there, piling contradiction on contradiction. Could you be specific about some of that?
Well, I just cite one example, defense. In 72, he said we shouldn't cut defense. It would be a tragedy. And in 75, he said we ought to cut $15 billion. Now he's saying $5 to $7 billion. The very time... Secretary Rumsfeld, our Secretary of Defense, is saying we ought to increase our defense budget, not for the sake of war, but for the sake of peace. It just seems to me that Governor Carter, in an effort to please some of the very liberal elements in this country, is going to shortchange us in the defense area.
Senator, as a candidate, what do you feel are some of the most important issues in this campaign?
Well, I think maybe not an issue, but I think very important factor is... who can provide the leadership for America? I think, secondly, we have some philosophical difference, very clear difference in the Carter-Mondale ticket, very, very liberal, and the Ford-Dole ticket. I think most Americans are concerned about spending. They're concerned about new government programs and federal interference. They want less of it. And they've seen President Ford demonstrate his courage in vetoing some of the big spending bills in an effort to save... all these taxpayers with inflation and increased taxes.
As you know, Senator Dole, Jimmy Carter came on real big as a Mr. Clean, and then came the Playboy interview. How do you address that?
Well, I say, first of all, it indicates, creates more doubt, and it's peculiar, and I think people are curious about why he would do this. Here's a man running for president, the highest office in the land, a man you're to look up to. I think, again, it's a question of judgment. It's a question of judgment. Why would he do this? And this is a decision he made that affects only him. But I'm more concerned about what judgment he might make if we had some real problem that affected me and all other Americans. I think it really shakes his credibility as a man who can look at something, look at it cold, and quietly make a judgment. He made a grave mistake as far as I'm concerned.
You've been campaigning extensively about the past week or so on a very busy schedule. I've been trying to keep up with some of the things that you've been saying here and there. And didn't you have something quite critical to say about the New York Times within the last 24 or 36 hours? And what was that all about?
No, it really wasn't critical. As I said, when I have something to say about the press, I say it openly. I don't have to call a private meeting, as Carter did, and try to intimidate the press. Really was nothing. They're not... I'm not one of their favorites, apparently. They've said so rather plainly, and beyond that, we get along very well. We have a fellow in the New York Times on the plane, Doug Neeland. We have a good relationship. I don't always agree with what he writes, but I have that right. He doesn't agree with what I say, and he has that right. So we get along fairly well with the press. We'd like to write our own copy, you understand, but we don't get to do that.
I wasn't invited to that meeting Carter had with the press. I don't know what happened. Do you know what happened there?
Well, I think he cried a little, and I don't mean really cried, but it's sort of like he, a few months ago, he said, no, they're going to attack me. They're going to be hard on me. I want you to all prepare for it, sort of bracing for it. So then he does the same thing to press, that you've been too hard on me, and you're not hard enough on President Ford. It indicates to me that he's in real trouble.
The next debate will be on foreign policy. Do you think in the next one there will be a clear-cut winner?
I think in the last one there was a clear-cut winner in President Ford. Every poll shows this to be a fact. And when you get into defense, it's going to be a walk-away. I hope Carter shows up.
Thank you, Senator.
He said in 1976 we ought to cut defense $5 to $7 billion. And he says this, my friends, at the very time our Secretary of Defense is saying we're going to have to increase defense spending if we want to maintain our strength. Now, I don't want to be number two in the world. You don't want to be a number two in the world. I want to be number one in the world for the sake of peace, and that's the only purpose. We want to be number one in the world. And we've got to retain our strength. We've got to remain strong. We've got to be the rallying point for freedom-loving people everywhere in this world. And I don't believe we can sit down across the table from the Russians or any other superpower in this world and say, well, you're number one and we're number two, but we want to make a deal with you. We want some accommodation. And I say we must speak from strength. And talking about that, I remember going to Seattle with a day after Governor Carter was there addressing the American Legion. He told the American Legion, as he does to many audiences, he tried to have it both ways. He knew the Legionnaires generally were against amnesty. So he got up and told the American Legion with a straight face, mind you, he said, I'm against amnesty, but I'm for a general pardon. Well, I got out my dictionary, the Third World Dictionary, and it says, under the word amnesty, it means general pardon for draft evaders. That's what he was talking about, a general pardon for draft evaders. World of ours, in this country of ours, there's still several hundred Americans missing in Southeast Asia. Some may be alive. Some may be prisoners of war. I'm more concerned, and President Ford is more concerned with those forgotten Americans in Southeast Asia than we are with those who forgot America in a time of need and left our country. And that's what it's all about. And that's how serious it is. And I just say that for someone who runs around talking about trust, and trust me, trust is something that must be earned. You don't call a former president, now deceased President Johnson, a liar and a cheat, someone who distorts the truth, and then call up his widow and apologize and think the whole thing's forgotten. You don't do that. Mrs. Johnson doesn't accept that, nor do the American people accept that. You don't run around this country talking about the rich and then run up to New York and have lunch. Call him a small businessman. Thank you very much. Everything's on here. It's good to be back in the Kiwanis Club. I am a Kiwanian, so I'll say that for whatever value it may be. Having been the president of my Kansas local club and also lieutenant governor, I
know a little about Kiwanis, and maybe you can give me a makeup or whatever happens after I finish speaking. I think I still get tab for $12 a year dues, so I'm sorry I got here too late to eat. But in any event, we apologize for being a little late, but the weather's not the best today for flying around, and we've just been a little behind schedule since leaving Chicago this morning. Now, I'll keep you only a few minutes because I know that most Kiwanians have to work for a living, and you may miss a sale right now, so if anything happens that suddenly moves you out of the room, I'll understand. Let me say, first of all, that I'm very pleased to have this opportunity. I understand what the rules are in Kiwanis about politics and politicians and partisan speeches, so I'll not make a political speech. I'll just tell you the truth. And you can summarize any way you wish after I've gone. I think it's fair to say, without revealing my party affiliation, that I'm on the ticket with President Ford. And I think perhaps it's fair to say that pineapple juice is better for you than peanut butter. For one thing, it doesn't stick to the roof of your mouth, and I don't know, there may be a number of other qualities, but I'm not related to the pineapple people. I might want to put in that disclaimer because I've checked it out, believe me, but I couldn't find any tie. I remember when I first ran for Congress, we served pineapple juice all over my district because people didn't know me from Adam. They didn't know it was Bob Doyle or Bob Dole or Bob Dahl or whatever. And we served a lot of pineapple juice, and we had nice-looking ladies serving little cups of pineapple juice, and the last thing you'd see in the cup was Dole for Congress. And after we successfully won that campaign, we mailed a whole lot of pictures from newspapers and other clippings to the Dole Pineapple Company in Hawaii, thinking they might send us a dispenser and a lot of pineapple juice we could serve in our office. But they sent me a price list, and that's how much they appreciated the advertising, I guess. But in any event, it was a lot of fun. Well, we've heard a great deal of talk about from Mr. Carter about trust and unity. I think they're very basic elements in our democratic system. And when any candidate invokes them as the key notes of his campaign, his claims require more than ordinary scrutiny. No candidate can be all things to all people. America is a combination of competing needs, of conflicting interests, and these must be balanced and reconciled to produce and serve the interests of the nation as a whole. But a candidate can be some things to all people. He can be consistent. He can be open. He can be honest. He can be decent. He can be dignified. He can be a man of integrity. But even if you cannot agree with him on every issue, you can at least recognize that he is going do what he believes is right. And this is the foundation of trust, and it must be built patiently over time by leaders who have a vision of this nation and of this nation for the future. And I say, yes, I'm a Republican, yes, I'm on the ticket, but I say President Ford has such a vision, and it's easily seen in the consistency and firmness with which he conducts his presidency. Mr. Carter does not. And it is seen in the vacillation and uncertainty which afflicts his every public remark. Mr. Carter tells the wage earner he will make big business swallow the cost of his spending programs by changing the tax structure. But he also went to Wall Street and told the folks there not to worry, that he wasn't going to be in any hurry to change the tax structure. Mr. Carter told the union leaders that he supported the Humphrey Hawkins bill, a multi-billion dollar government employment bill. But when called upon to outline his jobs program in debate with President Ford last week, he just left it out. And when he ran for governor in 1970 in the state of Georgia, Mr. Carter promised there would be no tax increase. But after he was elected, he proposed the state's first tax increase since 1955. And most of those taxes were direct consumer taxes, which hit hardest at the working man and the working woman. Per capita state tax collections rose 51% in Georgia during his tenure as governor. And now Mr. Carter presents his record in Georgia as one of an efficient administration and a budget-cutting administration. And the facts are that state employment rose 22% during his tenure and state spending rose 50%. And this is not the record of a man who deserves the trust of the American people. His claim that he will bring unity to this nation is contradicted by the very nature of his campaign. And let me add that as far as I view it, and as I see it, and as I understand it, and I've traveled around this country, this nation has grown strong on the diversity of our people. Each group has enriched our land, made it a little stronger, a little better. We are proud of our ethnic diversity, and of our religious diversity, and even our economic diversity, as a result of a system which provides opportunity and rewards, hard work, and provides an incentive to do better. And every day, Mr. Carter goes before the American people and tells them that they are victims of the rich, the big corporations, and the special interest groups. That's his stock stump speech. If he came to this Kiwanis Club, he'd look you right in the eye and say you're the victim of the rich and the special interest groups. And he talks of $50 martini lunches, tax loopholes, and accountants and lawyers reaping illegitimate benefits. All for the wealthy, all for the rich. Who are those faceless and nameless rich, the big corporations which Mr. Carter attacks? Do they include Henry Ford and other businessmen he lunched with at the 21 Club in New York about a week after their convention, when he told Henry Ford and these other small businessmen, "Don't worry about taxes, it's going to take me at least a year to look it over"? Are these the small businessmen? Do they include the Lockheed Corporation, which flew him to South America when he was governor of Georgia? Is that little businessman that he talks about? Or are they the median income taxpayers of this country? And according to statistics, and apparently Mr. Carter didn't realize at the time, the median income for the average American family is $14,000 a year, not $50,000, not $100,000, but I'm talking about median family income. That's a working wife, a working husband, or anyone else in that family. And he said he was going to raise their taxes to provide tax relief for everyone else. And who are the special interest groups? He doesn't name them, but he certainly makes it sound scary enough time after time after time. I just noted this morning, the interesting thing is that Common Cause had just released a list of those who received the most contributions from special interest groups, the top four. And guess which people had the list? Vance Hartke, Democrat, Indiana. John Tunney, Democrat, California. Harrison Williams, Democrat, New Jersey. Hubert Humphrey, Democrat, Minnesota. Not a Republican among the list. And I'm wondering if Governor Carter wants to castigate these four Democrat senators. Probably not. Do these groups include the labor unions who have given Mr. Carter their support? The farmers' groups, church groups, ethnic groups, professional associations, and other organizations whose members have a right to be heard in our democratic system? Are they all special interest groups? I don't know who these groups are because Mr. Carter won't say. It's better politics to scare than to declare. But in the end, Mr. Carter is condemning a process of government attempting to set us against each other to convince some of the people that the democratic system is not working, or is working against them. And all the time he calls for unity. He tells us there is a breakdown in trust among our people. But the truth is, and he knows what the truth is, he is seeking to create a breakdown in trust among our people and to create disunity and to exploit both. I think America deserves better. And I've known President Ford for some 16 years. We're not perfect. We've made mistakes. If you checked our voting records or checked any other record, you might find some areas where you had questions, and you have every right to question. You also have a right in America to an answer. The American people deserve an answer. And I've said in the past that we accommodated Mr. Carter by having three debates. He could give all of his positions on each issue on three separate nights. So we've had one debate, and there are two debates to go. And I would suggest, for the benefit of, oh, yes, people here in Williamsport or wherever we may be in America, that it's time the American people really knew what Mr. Carter stood for. And I say to my friends in Kiwanis and others who may be here this noon, you know, this is an important election. I assume that most of you are businessmen. Some of you know about the capital gains tax treatment. Mr. Carter said in an Associated Press interview that he was going to tax all income the same. So if you had stocks or bonds or sold property, all income would be taxed the same. Maybe that's what you want. He also said in that interview he didn't think Americans wanted their taxes lowered. Is there anyone in this group who doesn't want their taxes lowered? If there is, please raise your hand. We'll try to get medical treatment to you as quickly as we can. So I just say, whether you're a Democrat or Republican or independent or just slept through lunch and are still here, it's time we take notice. It's time we take stock. It's time we take a look. Someone asked George Meany why he didn't run for president. He said, why step down? And if Governor Carter's elected, there are going to be two hotlines, one to Russia and one to AFL-CIO headquarters, where George Meany can talk to him on a daily basis. And I suggest that labor has a great influence in America. They should have. I don't think the working men and women in this country necessarily want bigger spending, a weaker defense, more and more programs, higher taxes. And that's what Governor Carter advocates. Oh, he has a number of positions. He said in 1972, we shouldn't cut our defense. It'd be a tragedy. He said in 75, we ought to cut it $15 billion. He's now saying we ought to cut it $5 to $7 billion. Now, I don't want to be number one for any aggressive purpose. But I think if we're going to have a role to play in this world, as we have a role thrust upon us as a leader of the free world, we can't deal with Russia. We can't deal with any other superpower unless we're dealing from strength. I don't know how Mr. Carter's going to accomplish all. He said, we're going to be the strongest nation. We're going to balance the budget. We're going to end inflation. We're going to end unemployment. And you're going to all benefit from it. We're going to do that all at no cost to anyone. Do all those things, at least in his first term. Well, he's not going to have that first term. And while he's talking about loopholes, we ought to ask him what he means by loopholes. His tax liability for 1975 was $68,000. I imagine most of you paid at least $68,000 or more. But he didn't pay $68,000. He found a loophole, a $42,000 loophole, between $41,000 and $42,000. So he took a 10% investment tax credit on some peanut machinery, which is perfectly legal. I'm all for the investment tax credit. So he deducted $42,000 from $68,000, whatever it was. He paid about $17,000 taxes, or about 12.8% of his income. And I'll bet everyone in this room paid more than 12.8% of your income in taxes. But he stands before the poor. He stands before the average American, he says. And he rails out against the rich and the loopholes. And the hypocrisy flows and it flows and it flows. And it never ends. Climate's changing and the poles are changing. They're getting closer and closer and closer. They're so close now that Governor Carter had to have an off-the-record private meeting with newsmen. And he complained and cried a little bit, saying, you're just being too tough on me. You're asking me all the hard questions. Well, I think the press has a right to ask us the tough questions. We don't always like it. I've been stung myself a few times, and I've whelped a little too. We haven't had any private sessions where we tried to intimidate the press of this country. And that's a sign of a desperate man. That's a sign of impending disaster in someone's campaign or someone's business or whatever it may be. When he can't stand the heat, as Harry Truman says, he ought to get out of the kitchen. So he was back in Plains for a couple of days, regrouping, reassessing. Now he's back on the trail where he said that President Ford is responsible for all the unemployment, all the bad things in America. He said last night he accused President Ford of something, and he thought, well, he hasn't been accused of anything, so he changed his story. Now, He's had a lot of interviews lately. I'll have to confess, he's really been well covered. Some of the interviews will be published later this month. There'll be a lot of pictures in some of the interviews, and I'm certain the men will go right to the story and read it very carefully. Now, I don't know why I gave the interview. I think it shows bad judgment. That only affects Governor Carter. That's a judgment he made that affects him. What I'm concerned about is what judgment is he going to make that affects us if he's the President of the United States? Who's he going to confide with? Is he going to call the editor of Playboy and ask him if it's a good judgment? I don't think so. So I think we look at the judgment of a man. And what kind of a man is it that says a man's a liar and a cheat and distorts the facts, as he talked about the late President Johnson, and then rushes to the phone to call his widow? Mrs. Johnson, well, he didn't mean it. I apologize. I just think we have to consider these facts in a nonpartisan way, as we're doing here at noon. They told me not to make a partisan speech. Someone said, how can you tell Senator Dole from Senator Mondale? Well, they say Mondale's always a George Meany, too. And I just say to you as businessmen, and I hope some Democrats are here, and I hope some working men and women are here. Oh, let's listen to George Meany. He has a pretty good record on defense. I don't know how he buys the Carter effort to weaken us. But let's not give it all to organized labor. They control the Congress. I'm going to get Joe elected. That'll help a little. But he's replacing a Republican, Herm Schnabley. But let's take a hard look. You're going to give George Meany the White House? He's already got a key ring a mile long. There ought to be some balance. There ought to be some balance. President Ford vetoed his 59th bill yesterday, and it was tough. But it was $4 billion over the budget. $4 billion over the budget. And he's had the courage time after time after time, despite all the criticism of Governor Carter, to stand up for America, to try to cool the fires of inflation. And it's been cut in half. So I just leave you with that thought. President Ford has the experience. He has demonstrated leadership. He's cool. He's confident. He's competent. And so the choice we make on November 2nd is an important choice. And I figured out along the way that if Ford makes it, I'm going to make it. So I... And I guess if I were like Carter, I'd say the first thing I'm going to do is invite all the Kwanians to Washington. He's invited everybody in America to come to the White House. I went down to the races somewhere in South Carolina, the Darlington 500. And he didn't think I should be. His press secretary said it was tacky of me to come. Well, I didn't know that he went to tacky places, but I was there. I have a right to be there. It's a free country. Kind of makes you stop and think what might happen if he were elected. But he invited everybody there to the White House. I can't invite you to the White House. I can invite you, I don't know, the vice president. He has a little place up there now. It's the fancy bed and all those things. We could invite you.